Hi, everyone. Before we get into episode two, we wanted to let you know that we just made a Discord server for Book on Fire community and discussion. So the Discord server's got a few folks on it already, but we're inviting any and all who might want to have some Book on Fire convo with us and with other listeners. And we already have some lively discussion on there. So check that out if you're interested.
The link to the Discord server is in the show notes. I'm going to put it in the notes so you can find it there. And I'll have it in the show notes of each of the episodes that we publish this season. All right, enjoy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Book on Fire podcast, season 3, episode 2.
That's right.
Today, we're going to be talking about the chapter that's called Wicked Liberty, the Indigenous Critique, and the Myth of Progress.
Yeah, this is chapter 2 of the book. It's kind of where the book sort of starts properly. Chapter 1 is almost like an introduction. And I just want to say that I think this chapter is really great.
It's great.
One of my favorite chapters in the book, for sure. And we are not going to totally be able to do it justice here. I was just, you know, rereading this again, and there's just almost every paragraph, especially in the early parts of the chapter, has like a really just fun, like a tasty morsel of like something to chew on that is like food for thought in some kind of way. They're really good at that. And this chapter has a lot of it.
There's also just so much lively and entertaining history in this chapter. And quotes from people. We'll get to all of that.
Maybe. We'll get to some of the really good stuff, and we will read to you, or we might have a guest read to you from some of the tastier bits. But okay, we don't want to give away too much. But the Indigenous Critique and the Myth of Progress gives you a little bit of a clue about what we're going to get to in this chapter. But to begin at the beginning, the authors start off by reminding us about Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau is a kind of a prop that they use throughout this book, especially in the beginning chapters, to sort of lay the groundwork. So they remind us that Rousseau left us a story about the origins of social inequality. That is a story of how humans progressed, or maybe devolved, from happy, free, innocent, maybe even childlike beings in a state of nature. And then as they gradually discovered more technologies, found each other, started living in communities, started farming, they slid into a pipeline that led to greater complexity, but also in some ways greater bondage and what we would call today hierarchy and loss of freedoms. And Rousseau, in fact, gave us this story in an essay that he wrote in 1754 called Discourse on the Origin and the Foundation of Inequality Among Mankind. And Rousseau wrote this essay as a submission to an essay contest that was specifically on the topic of social inequality. The prompt for the contest was, what is the origin of inequality among men, and is it authorized by natural law? And Graeber and Wingrow begin the chapter by asking, why were elite Europeans, like Western Europeans, even concerned with the question of inequality at this point? Like, not just Rousseau, but obviously the academy that held the essay contest was asking for submissions on the question of social inequality. And they talk a little bit about how that was like maybe a really unusual thing, especially for elites to be thinking about in Western Europe, or Northern Europe is the way that they put it, at the time. Mm-hmm. And that actually at this time, social stratification, hierarchy, and vast degrees of inequality was actually naturalized, you might say, in European culture at the time. Like, it was taken as a norm, as something that was maybe ordained by God, like various justifications for this, especially the people who were benefiting from the hierarchies, were very invested in thinking that they were just normal and natural and proper. And so why all of a sudden start thinking and asking about how inequality got started? And what Graeber and Wengrow propose as an explanation for this is that this time period in Northern Europe was shortly after Northern Europe had experienced what they call a shock of being integrated into the larger world and the people of the wider world. And that before then, in the Middle Ages, Europe, Northern Europe especially, was, they call it, you know, basically a cultural backwater, a place that was actually exceptional in being isolated and ignorant of a lot of the world's peoples. And that beginning with, you know, what is sometimes called the Age of Exploration, but also the Age of Colonization, Europeans in this part of Europe became more and more exposed to people who they before did not know much about or did not even know existed, including people in the Far East, like Chinese and what we would call like the Indian subcontinent today, but also, and especially of concern in this chapter, people of the Western Hemisphere, people of the Americas. And because of this, all of a sudden, Northern Europeans were exposed to people from all over the place and their ideas and lots of different ways of living that they had not been exposed to before. And that the ultimate result of that flood of new ideas and new examples of living was to be called the Enlightenment.
Right. So yeah, this is, I think this is just so fascinating. And to be clear, this is what Wengrow and Graeber are putting forward here is something that indigenous scholars have already suggested and brought forth evidence for in some ways, that there is a strong influence or a foundational effect of the ideas of indigenous people from Turtle Island on the Enlightenment thinkers who would become famous for those ideas.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. The part of this history that has had more like mainstream and popular acceptance is like you might have heard that the political system of the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois Confederacy was one of the models for the Constitution of the United States.
All right.
Like this is something that you hear more about, but what's being proposed here more kind of broadly and radically, not just by Graeber and Wengrow, but by the primarily indigenous scholars who they've had access to, is that not just in these little ways, but just broader, the whole foundation of the Enlightenment was actually very substantially a product of Europeans having to grapple with new ideas, especially coming from indigenous Americans.
Yeah, and the challenges, the questioning of European society and values that indigenous people put forth.
Right.
Because, and we'll get to this more in a bit, but the criticism of many indigenous folks who were recorded in the history of the early colonial period are pretty devastating and spot on.
Yeah, it's not just that Europeans were exposed to new kinds of people. It's that those people were criticizing the European way of life in very harsh terms.
And very eloquent terms that were very hard to ignore and couldn't just be brushed aside.
Oh,
and so, you know, these writers, the authors, the Davids here, are basically saying that created an entire body of philosophical thought and literature.
Right, right.
To deal with that critique.
And the more official history would have it that the ideas of the Enlightenment came substantially from a kind of rediscovery of the classical world.
The Greeks.
And especially the ancient Greeks and rereading the dialogues of Plato and Aristotle and Socrates and rediscovering Athenian democracy and all of this stuff. And that is a factor. I mean, we don't want to just say it's a black or white situation, but the indigenous influence has been vastly underappreciated.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I should probably take a minute and just like remind people what we mean when we say the Enlightenment.
Yeah, let's do that.
Or the Age of Enlightenment.
Yeah.
So we talked about the Enlightenment some during the Caliban and the Witch, or actually a good bit.
Right.
Pretty disparaging ways.
There's a whole chapter where it comes under intense scrutiny.
Right. But just to remind folks, the Enlightenment is not all bad. there are some good things that we associate with the Enlightenment, but basically that is a period of philosophical writing and thought that had pretty world-changing impact on how political systems were run continue to be run today. Some of the key ideas of the Enlightenment are separation of church and state. That was really big at the time because the church and state in Western Europe at that time were one.
Yeah.
With a lot of harsh implications for people living there of different faiths or who were not subscribing to whatever the doctrine of the day was. This led to a lot of religious wars in many places in Europe.
The church was seen as an oppressive institution.
Yes.
Including, you know, maybe almost especially by common people.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was in a lot of ways a popular move to make to subvert the authority of the church.
Mm-hmm. And there was an elevation of reason and science and learning through the senses, empiricism.
Rationality.
And, you know, we have some critiques of that now, but at the moment, it was another way of subverting faith-based doctrine and faith-based law and faith-based oppression.
Yeah.
So remembering that this idea that how people treat each other and how society should be set up was not just going to go back to how the church was teaching that God ordained things to be, that it was not just going to be faith-based, felt freeing and liberating for people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas there are ones that make sense.
Yeah.
Or that can feel, it can feel like it probably was an improvement if those theories were actually put into place in a fair way.
Yeah.
And I think that I want to emphasize this here because I can really hate on the Enlightenment, and I've done so on this podcast heartily in the past. But just to say that as we are living here in the United States under an increasingly Christo-fascist, authoritarian-leaning government, or at least parts of it. There's a big movement,
including within
that.
The government.
Within the government, yeah, not just in the government, but including within the government, we are seeing a move towards less of a separation of church and state, and more of a faith-based law being put down on other people's bodies.
Yeah.
As we move towards that, I just want to hold up that ideal of keeping those separate came from a place that I can get behind, right? That there is something to admire in wanting those factions to be separate. And just remembering that while we can say, yeah, the people who were writing about this and the founding fathers of this country are hypocrites and full of shit in all these ways, it is definitely true that keeping those separate as a goal is something admirable.
Right.
If we're going to have a state, let it not be one that is oppressing a certain faith-based religion on everyone else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Also, within the Enlightenment, there became an emphasis on individual liberty, natural law, rights.
Rights.
Human rights.
Human rights. Yeah.
With mixed results. But just to say that this was the kind of cluster of ideas that people were talking about and theorizing with at that point.
Yeah. So with the Enlightenment, we get at least a vague idea that freedom is good.
Yeah.
You know, in theory, at least a certain amount.
Measured freedom.
Of freedom is good. Yeah. And that, like, equality is also a value, you know? And of course, we see how the Enlightenment actually would play out and how the foundation of the United States included slavery, even though they were lip servicing Enlightenment values. And so, you know, the translation of the values into the reality was really abysmal. But these values start emerging, you know. And then, yes, it also comes with, like, the Enlightenment is tied up in the emergence of science and objective scientific method, rationality.
The reign of reason.
Type of stuff. You know, it's all kind of part of this package. And yeah, as Janet was alluding to, especially in these times, the Enlightenment has a very mixed reception, I would say, for, like, leftists and radicals, you know, depending. And different people have different opinions of it. But, you know, on one hand, yes, the values of the Enlightenment are part of what have been used, you know, to acquire more civil rights for different people in the the liberal democracies of the modern West, and science has given us some benefits and medical science and so forth. But also, you know, and if you want to hear more about this, you can go back and hear, I don't remember which chapter it is in Caliban and the Witch, but
maybe we can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, but Federici in that book makes a really good argument that actually what was happening during the Enlightenment intellectually was kind of a necessary precursor for the formation of capitalism and for the reign of capitalism, that a new conception of humans and a kind of like rationality and disenchantment of the world had to sort of be accomplished for capitalism to really be able to take hold and be as like normalized and naturalized as it is now. And so the Enlightenment in that sense can be seen as a very violent and manipulative instrumentalizing of ideas in order to erect a new regime of domination. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the whole disenchantment aspect we can critique even kind of on its own.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that the reign of reason and the reign of empiricism meant the denigration of anything that you can't directly document from the senses.
Yeah.
You know, and so this meant the persecution of a lot of people who practice all kinds of forms of spirituality. It meant the denigration of animism. It meant having a very objectifying relationship with nature.
Right.
A very extractive relationship with the world.
It's much easier to see a forest as just a potential resource for a sawmill.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've like stripped the conceptual world that sees the trees as animate beings that you have a relationship with as peers.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, I want to come back to this at the end, but I will say that while I am pretty convinced at the arguments put forth here that a lot of Enlightenment thoughts came from Indigenous critique or were in response to Indigenous critique, I think it's interesting that those were extricated from an enchanted worldview where humans were very much in relationship with their environs,
right.
You know, and so that part just got like kind of kicked to the curb because it was not instrumental in the project.
Yeah, right. So here they're talking about how Indigenous Americans informed the Enlightenment, but obviously only in very specific ways because the Enlightenment also accomplished a great disenchantment. You know, which was not a feature of Indigenous America.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Right.
And the level of enchantment that informed Indigenous experience and worldview was also used as an excuse for oppressing them and for some violence committed against them.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it's interesting what was picked of that worldview to support European thought and what was not.
And in this book, Graeber and Wengrow are concerned with the political world of Indigenous Americans. So in that sense, in that one restricted sense, they're tracing the influence of those political ideas in Europe into the Enlightenment. And so they are able to give the Enlightenment like positive content in that sense. And yeah, I think it's also kind of interesting that they don't account for the bigger picture like you're talking about.
Right.
And, you know, there's a separate conversations that we don't need to have now about like that. I do think that in certain ways, David Graeber is a product of the Enlightenment for better and for worse.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think,
you know, as an intellectual. Yeah.
Sometime in the course of this season, we need to talk about the way that Wengrow and Graeber are continuing that project of separating. The Indigenous political thought from the worldview they're embedded in.
Yeah.
And what the implications of that are.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, before we get into the substance of the early intellectual encounter between European colonizers and Indigenous people in the northeast of Turtle Island, which is a lot of what this chapter is, it might be good to actually just state the thesis of the chapter, because the authors do it pretty early on. This is going to become more relevant when we get to the end of the chapter, but their thesis here and what they're going to try and show by the chapter's end is that the very theory and concept of stages of the evolution of human culture, you know, that we talked about in chapter one and that the authors are complaining about in general, that, you know, however you want to conceive of it, starting as hunter-gatherers or starting as, you know, humans in a state of nature, going through to agriculture, becoming less free, becoming more complex, you know, developing hierarchies, that this whole story of these evolutionary stages of human culture was invented to silence the indigenous critique of European culture. Mm-hmm. That was its functional role as it emerged in the history of ideas. Because the Europeans were basically experienced an existential crisis in encountering a bunch of people in the Americas who were happier, more free than they were, and that it caused them to question, or it threatened to cause them to question, the foundations of their whole society. Mm-hmm. And so they therefore had to invent a system whereby they could say that these people were merely representatives of like a backward old stage mm-hmm. of humanity that was no longer relevant to the world that Europeans were living in. And so therefore they didn't have to consider it too deeply.
And also maybe that they were in a primitive state that was a predecessor to what happened in Europe, that they would too probably evolve or like move into the various stages of society eventually. It's just they hadn't done it yet.
Yeah, because that was, and we'll get to this, but part of the theory is that like there's a natural pull.
Yeah.
There's some kind of gravitational pull towards the state. And complex, stratified, technologically advanced, whatever you want to mean by that, societies, and that these cultures that were encountered on Turtle Island reflected a primitive stage of that development, and that if let be, presumably, they would like naturally turn into something like Western Europe or something, but with different specific cultural features, presumably. But I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
Here at the beginning, that like there, that this is where we're going, mm-hmm. and this is the argument that is being made overall, you know, but they take their time doing it, and there's a lot of good stuff along the way, and there's actually a lot that you can draw from this chapter without even really engaging with that part of the argument, but we're going to be engaging with it. So
they began describing the encounters of French settlers, or at least temporary settlers in some cases, and indigenous folks in what was called New France by the Europeans at the time, meaning, you know, parts of what is now called Canada and Northern United States.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah.
Where France was actively colonizing at the time, which is why French is still spoken in that part
of right.
the continent.
Yeah. Right. So the reason we have records of these exchanges is because the missionaries that were sent along were Jesuits.
Yeah, these missionaries were often like on the leading edge
right.
of colonization, right? Yeah. And it still is that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
But the Jesuits were the missionaries that were specifically sent on these ventures.
Right.
And for people who don't know, the Jesuit lineage of Catholicism is one that has a really heavy emphasis on education and literacy and being able to argue well, because they really emphasized talking people into conversion.
Conversion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also arguing the Catholic stance in relationship to other kinds of Christian stances as well. But, you know, we still have like a lot of Jesuit colleges and Jesuit schools that are in this lineage as well. Mm-hmm. There's an emphasis on being well-read and well-spoken and being able to argue. And
yeah, it's an intellectual current.
Yeah, within that right. tradition. Uh-huh. Yes. The Jesuits are also interestingly associated with a lot of different conspiracies during this time period and later as well.
Definitely so.
But
yes.
that was a side thing here. So they wrote about their experiences of attempting to convert indigenous people of Turtle Island.
Yeah.
And
the people we're talking about, just so we right. say, the folks who appear in the Jesuit accounts that are quoted in this book are Montagnana-Scappi people who are, at the time of this, were like mostly hunter-gatherer people, like living pretty far north in Canada, and then, but also Mi'kmaq people on the coast of what's now called Nova Scotia, and there's also Iroquoian people. So all different cultures and language groups from this one region.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they were, the Jesuit missionaries were also always writing home, and I mean, or writing the church about what they were doing. You know, they would report back on their experiences, and some of these reports were published as well.
There was a collection that was called The Jesuit Relations of New France, which was basically a bestseller in Europe. This was, literate people ate this shit up. I mean, and you can imagine why.
And then imagine that these people that are being encountered for the first time are, on the whole, pretty well-spoken, good at arguing, and very critical of the people that they're interacting with.
Yeah.
And so that part is so fascinating about these reports from the Jesuits, because they are missionaries who are used to honestly having an easier time talking people into signing up for the faith.
Yeah, they're kind of trained in some ways in manipulation.
Absolutely.
You know, and they would they learn the languages of the natives and then, you know, try and
convert them. Right.
You know, and try and persuade them.
And their letters and reports contain a lot of complaints about how intelligent even everyday villagers are.
Yeah.
And how almost anyone they talk to is highly critical, able to argue their way out of whatever conversation they're having, and so unconvinced of anything the Jesuits have to say.
Yeah, it's almost like the Native Americans had prepped for these conversion attempts in advance.
Right.
The Jesuits seem very taken aback by how oftentimes little headway they can make with these folks, and how those folks like basically turn, maybe not the persuasion, but the arguments at least around, and just are very resistant to the idea that they should live like the Europeans in any way.
Father Pierre Biard, for example, was a former theology professor assigned in 1608 to evangelize the Algonquian-speaking Mi'kmaq in Nova Scotia, who had lived for some time next to a French fort. Biard did not think much of the Mi'kmaq, but reported that the feeling was mutual. They consider themselves better than the French, for, they say, you are always fighting and quarrelling among yourselves. We live peaceably. You are envious and are all the time slandering each other. You are thieves and deceivers. You are covetous and are neither generous nor kind. As for us, if we have a morsel of bread, we share it with our neighbour. They are saying these and like things continually.
So that is an excerpt from the audiobook, actually, the audiobook version of The Dawn of Everything. It's a pretty good audiobook.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And I would say if you're into listening and you don't have a lot of time to like read, you might want to get the audiobook because it's pretty engaging.
It's a pretty easy book to listen to in the way that it's written, because it's written in a pretty conversational style, even though it is like information dense kind of at the same time. So we're going to put a few of these excerpts from the audiobook when we're trying to include a quote from some of these accounts and some of these dialogues. And in this case, a Jesuit father trying to come to terms with his conversations with the Mi'kmaq.
It's Father Biard, and he refers to almost like continual criticism that he receives in conversation with these people. And one thing that really gets on his nerves is that the various Mi'kmaq folks that he talks to say that when they assess their lives and compare them to the European lives around them, they find themselves richer, and they call the European poor, because they say, we, the Mi'kmaq, have more comfort, we have more ease, and we have more time.
Which they considered greater assets than all the material possessions that the Europeans had. And you can imagine how this would infuriate a European who they might envy, at least subconsciously envy, you know, some things about the indigenous way of life, but they might
comfort themselves
by thinking, well, we have more, we are wealthier though.
Yeah.
We have more possessions and things of value.
Yeah. And that's going to be a recurring motif in this chapter, because various critics, indigenous critics, bring up the, like, they're just like, God, you guys spend so much time getting ready every day, and you're like, so you just like keep busy with bullshit basically, right, so that you can just have more stuff. Like the criticism around time I find really fascinating.
Yeah,
actually. And I'm like, for right sure. Like right. They're like, the stuff is not worth how much time you spend on it, you know?
And they're good at like turning things around, mm-hmm, on the Europeans too, you know, like this, like, you think you're rich, but what is being rich actually,
right,
you know, and all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty clever. It's often pretty clever. So they follow this one up, this quote from another quote that we like, and we're going to share. This one is from a Jesuit brother, or a Recollect friar, Brother Gabriel Sagard, and he was hanging out with the Wendat Nation. The Wendats come up from time to time in this book, and we should say that they're also sometimes known as the Huron, mm-hmm, but the Huron is more of like a European name for these people,
right,
and so like the Wendat is another way that they can be known, and that's the term that they use in this book. So here's a quote from Brother Sagard's writings where he's commenting on Wendat attitudes towards hospitality and generosity.
They reciprocate hospitality and give such assistance to one another that the necessities of all are provided for without there being any indigent beggar in their towns and villages. And they considered it a very bad thing when they heard it said that there were in France a great many of these needy beggars, and thought that this was for lack of charity in us, and blamed us for it severely.
Yeah, and this points to another recurring theme in the indigenous critique that the Jesuits were reporting to back to Europe at this point, and it's that what they saw was a general like selfishness and greed and, yeah, absence of generosity amongst the Europeans.
Yeah.
And these observations are pretty interesting because they don't just talk about food, although they are really alarmed at how much Europeans seem to be reluctant to share food with each other.
Yeah. And that there's a lot of hungry people, apparently, yeah, in
right
Europe.
Right.
You know, who don't have enough to eat.
Yes.
Yeah.
So they're alarmed by that, but also they feel like, or they describe European interactions as also seeming somewhat selfish and greedy. And they talk about how when they're all just kind of hanging out that, well, honestly, the French come off as kind of boorish. Like, they talk over each other. They seem to just like only be waiting for their turn to talk, if they even wait for their turn to talk. They're just like greedy, yeah, with attention and greedy with their time as well. In this way, that's like their power relations and selfishness are not just about material goods or food. It's also just about like energetic exchange,
yeah,
you know, and that the indigenous folks in this section and in some of the other criticism that was relayed back to Europe includes just a kind of overall bad impression of these French settlers.
Yeah. You can almost imagine how they're like, they're making these connections where they're like, yeah, you let people starve on the street and you're all like hungry for wealth. And the way you act in conversation is like that too. You
right
talk over each other. Everyone is just greedy for their turn to talk and right blah, blah, like all this thing. And it's like, it reminds me of when I'm really upset with a person or a situation
yeah,
and like everything is meaningful and related about how bad they are.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
all of
yeah
a sudden.
You yeah start to create like a constellation
right
that makes a picture. You
yeah
know?
Yeah, and, like, painting a picture.
And they're clearly doing that mm-hmm with their mm-hmm the occupants of their land. You know,
yeah, and this is kind of how this works for us too. I mean, and for the Europeans at the time, is because to hear from somebody who has witnessed your culture, like the Europeans' culture, and just can't believe that even though they consider themselves wealthy, that there's hungry, starving, needy people
mm-hmm
too, and just like it does seem like common sense
right
to be like, what is up with that?
Yeah.
You know, and the Europeans have to like come up with ways to rationalize and justify that in a way that they didn't have to before.
Yeah, especially in the context of these like missionaries, because they're preaching this gospel of like a compassionate Christ
mm-hmm
who actually
right
cared about poor people.
Yeah.
And so like the contradictions are just heavy, right? I
right
mean, like, so the indigenous folks are like, what are you even talking about? That's not how you guys treat each other, you know?
Yeah.
So that's also interesting because
right
the people relaying this culture and trying to spread this religious tradition actually are maybe the most exposed to these contradictions, right?
I mean, it's not surprising that the indigenous critics were very quick to seize on these contradictions and to see them, because frankly, the contradictions are obvious, you know, and they, at least they seem obvious to us now, looking back in retrospect.
Yeah, and another thing that comes up a lot in the critiques is that the indigenous folks saw that they were more free, that they had more individual freedom, and they
that
would
they themselves were more free.
And they would like talk about how they would see these soldiers and various like functionary settlers like basically like cowering before the people who were their bosses or their captains.
Yeah.
You know, and they saw how some people were able to coerce other people, sometimes violently, into doing things they didn't want to do. And that the whole culture seemed to run under fear and domination. And they were like, what is this? Why would you choose this as a way of life?
Yeah.
You know, and they saw that not only did they have more ease, comfort, and time, that those together added up to just a general, like, more of a sense of freedom, you know?
Yeah, and the Jesuits noticed this too. That was not something that there was actually a disagreement about. The Jesuits frequently noted that these folks enjoyed more freedom than they did, and that Europeans did in general.
But they didn't see that as a plus, and that's important.
Yeah, they didn't really count that as a win for the indigenous folks, because they were very suspicious about freedom in general. There was like a ideological suspicion about freedom, at least coming from the like elite intellectual classes in Europe. And among other things, they tended to see the exercise of freedom as something kind of lower or base and like animalistic almost, as this following quote demonstrates.
They imagine that they ought by right of birth to enjoy the liberty of wild ass colts, rendering no homage to anyone whomsoever except when they like. They have reproached me 100 times because we fear our captains, while they laugh at and make sport of theirs. All the authority of their chief is in his tongue's end, for he is powerful in so far as he is eloquent, and even if he kills himself talking and haranguing, he will not be obeyed unless he pleases the savages.
I love this part. I love this quote. You can just hear the derision sort of dripping off of the voice of this Jesuit missionary. They imagine they ought by right of birth to enjoy the liberty of wild ass colts. And also, I just think that the observation that the authority of the chief is in their tongue's end, the way they put it in here, is an important observation, you know, that really to be a leader of any kind involves the ability to persuade and convince people, but that there's actually no way to coerce those people into doing anything. There's no actual power, like coercive power, only conversational persuasive power.
Yeah. And that juxtaposition of like, so in the indigenous cultures that you're referring to, where the eloquence of the leaders was actually essential to them being able to get folks to do anything.
To be considered a leader at all.
Right. Yeah. While, you know, leaders in the European tradition that many of these Jesuit missionaries had probably seen might not be especially smart or eloquent. They just inherited their titles.
Yeah.
You know, and so that is really, and they can compel people because they have the force of the state behind them or the force of their guards or whatever, you know, different social situation they're in.
Their rank.
Yeah. And so that's the difference. Like they're born into it, but leaders in these indigenous cultures that the Jesuits were dealing with actually had to continually prove themselves effective through conversation and persuasion.
Yeah, right. You know? Right. Yeah, because you can see here part of what the Jesuits are grappling with is that there were these roles, which they sometimes call captains, that seem to be leadership roles, but that the people in those roles often had very little actual coercive power.
Right.
And so, you know, you see them trying to like figure out how this works. You know,
Yeah, and they'll even give examples of, like, people just making fun of their chiefs and stuff,
yeah.
you know, really regularly.
Yeah.
Which, and maybe we'll talk about this in the next episode when we talk about some anthropology, but there are mechanisms in place that there's a culture of kind of, like, undermining the power that's right. happening in these cultures that the Jesuits are observing.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly. A very careful attention to what, you know, what helps people be free and what keeps hierarchies from forming.
Right.
And we should probably say and point out that the quotes that we have presented so far are all from different indigenous groups.
Right.
And we don't want to be homogenizing too much about, you know, that they were all the same as far as their attitudes towards power and their social organization. The last quote was in reference to some Montagnana-Scapi people, which at the time that the contact was happening, these were nomadic hunter-gatherers. The Wendat people were town-dwelling agricultural people. And the way that social life was organized in these different groups was different mm-hmm. in every case. And there was like more or less degrees of hierarchy and things like that in these different cultures. But still, despite all of that, and this is part of what they point out in the book, despite all of that variation, they all saw very clearly about what was contradictory mm-hmm. and very unfree and very ungenerous about European culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they saw the paucity of the lives of the yeah. Europeans around them.
Yeah.
I should point out here, too, just to be clear, that it is definitely worth noting that most of the French that these folks were coming into contact with, you know, it was like the first wave.
Yeah.
So this is like the early Jesuit missionaries, the early settlers. It's like soldiers, probably some trappers. You know, it's all men.
Yeah,
there aren't children and women.
Men. Yeah.
And it's probably, you know, some people who might be adventurers, but others who are just kind of like need a job, you know? And so
yeah.
just to say that like the culture might have been maybe especially boorish because of who was there. I just want to say that because Wingrove and Graeber do point out that like, you know, like generally when women and children are also in the communities that are interacting, there tends to be like some more forms of cooperation showing up or some more sharing, you know?
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah. It's a more well-rounded view.
Although probably would still be much less generous and more, still a less appealing lifestyle.
Yeah.
Even when there are more kinds of people around.
Yeah, and just to give y'all an example of just how not on the same page the Jesuits and the indigenous Americans were about the idea that liberty is even a value mm-hmm. or something to aspire to, we have this quote in which a Father Lallemant assessed the way that his indigenous interlocutors were disposed to this idea of freedom as a value mm-hmm. and how the Jesuits were actually opposed to freedom in principle.
This, without doubt, is a disposition quite contrary to the spirit of the faith, which requires us to submit not only our wills, but our minds, our judgments, and all the sentiments of man to a power unknown to our senses, to a law that is not of earth, and that is entirely opposed to the laws and sentiments of corrupt nature.
I think that we can say that the Jesuits, the clergy who were attempting to convert people on Turtle Island, were probably especially suspect of liberty and freedom, because the doctrine that they were trying to transmit, what the religion that they were converting people to, was like especially antithetical to freedom, because it requires not questioning, it requires obedience, it requires accepting the order of things.
Right, right.
And so we can say that Jesuits were maybe especially suspect of freedom. And,
yeah.
you know, in Christianity, freedom can easily be tied to sin and capacity for sin.
Right, right.
And in fact, our ability to choose and have free will is linked to sin from the beginning in the origin story of Christianity.
Yeah. And it says it like right there in the quote, corrupt nature.
Right, right, right.
Too,
yeah.
is that freedom is a property of nature, mm-hmm. which is corrupt.
Right.
And that humans are on a pathway in Christianity sort of away from nature and towards the divine, which requires their submission to the authority of God and his representatives on earth.
Right. But even outside of the Jesuit response to this level of freedom, the different various governments of Europe and thinkers and philosophers of Europe also had to contend with this issue and the disparity in freedom between Europeans and indigenous folks. And they also were troubled by this idea that these people seemed to be free and needed to decide that was wrong for them to maintain their social order at home.
Yes. So far, we have all of these accounts of the Jesuits and the debates that they were getting into with these Wendat and Mi'kmaq, etc., who they were interacting with and how they were just forced to examine and kind of account for their European ways of life. And these people were such good debaters. And Graeber and Wengrow, they actually are going to argue that almost just like the structure of the Enlightenment itself was influenced by this, because the Enlightenment, the culture of the Enlightenment was like a culture of debate. And people would get together in these like salons and coffee houses and stuff and debate political philosophy. And as we'll see in a minute, a lot of really influential and important Enlightenment texts were structured as dialogues and debates. And what they want to propose is that the Enlightenment was this way because of these debates that the Europeans were forced to have all the time with these indigenous folks that they were trying to convert.
And it also ties into the overall, I don't know, like average intelligence that was perceived by the Jesuits of these different groups of people. And Wengrow and Graeber also seem to be saying that the cultures that are described here had really vibrant, active discussions around just like everyday affairs amongst themselves.
They you know, because one of the things that we talked about already, I think, is how the Europeans were impressed by like pretty much everybody who they talked to was able to make good arguments, you know, and push back and hold their own. And what they're theorizing in here, and I think this is their own theory, I don't think they're encapsulating somebody else's, is that this skill in debating and speaking and making good arguments was honed by collectively managing common affairs in their tribe or band or whatever in like meetings, like basically, where people would take turns talking and they would decide things collectively. And one thing that I find amusing about all of this is that it just really, it just makes me think about Occupy, like Occupy Wall Street, and how Graeber was connected to Occupy Wall Street. And Occupy Wall Street was like notorious for having these daily assemblies, you know. And Graeber has always been like a very fierce advocate for these types of assemblies and consensus processes. And I've actually heard that he was like a really great consensus facilitator in real life. So he sees, when he looks back in the Haudenosaunee and the Wendat people, he's like, that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
They were doing consensus. They were doing assemblies just like we were doing back in Occupy.
Right. You know?
So I think there's a little bit of like a pet obsession there.
Well, and it does seem to be that they're saying that like, that participation and collaboration in governance makes you smarter, makes people happier, and it makes the individuals who are part of that process more engaged and better at critical thinking.
And critical, right. Because even though, you know, these Mi'kmaq and Wendat, et cetera, people were mostly in these conversations being critical of European society, you get to do that so well because you are, you have honed your critical faculties, including being critical about things that might be coming up in your own society, right? And so that's kind of the point that they're trying to make. And yeah, I think it's super interesting, right? And that if you actually have a voice, if you have a say in deciding things, which people in indigenous societies mostly did, at least some say, then you get practice using your voice. You know? I mean, it's kind of just like that. We'll be right back.
now we finally get to discuss maybe one of the most interesting figures in recorded colonial history, in the written history of Turtle Island after contact with Europeans.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say one of the most interesting figures in the book.
No, I'm
going bigger. Which is definitely true. And yeah, but you're going bigger than that. That's good. I like it.
I think that Candy Arronk, which is the name of the Wendat statesman that we'll be talking about, is a fascinating character.
Kind of the centerpiece of the chapter in a lot of ways, even though they've got a side hustle thing going on with Rousseau. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get into it.
So the setup that they create to bring Candy Arronk on stage here in this chapter is to introduce us first to a Frenchman who is the Baron de La Honton, who we'll just call La Honton. That's what he became known over time.
Yeah.
He was in the French army, and he was stationed in occupied Canada, what they were calling Canada at that point.
Yeah.
Or, why do you call it New France, actually?
Yeah, the Jesuit books are from New France, quote-unquote, you know, so probably still.
Yes.
I don't know.
He went there when he was 17, and he had a gift for languages and learns Algonquian and also Wendat. And he spent some time, eventually got all the way up to being deputy to the governor there, and was, you know, just around for a pretty good time, for a number of years.
So he was hanging out with some high-level French colonial functionaries.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And during that time, he hung out with the governor, who would host these evenings of lively debate with Candy Arronk. And Candy Arronk is this Wendat statesman who was well-known by everyone who met him from the European world, but also well-known in the many First Nations that he moved within, as an eloquent spokesman and just an outstanding mind, like extremely intelligent, extremely well-spoken, and pretty much unbeatable in debate.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
It's so interesting to read about him. Like, some of the Jesuits who write about him talk about how they think there might not be a more intelligent person.
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of incredible.
The highest praise that I've read of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And Candy Arronk was involved in a pretty massive scale geopolitical, like, machination plan.
Yeah.
Strategically working with the French, the English, and the Haudenosaunee and the Wendat Confederacy to try to play the English and the French against each other somewhat, but also just to sort of organize unified indigenous resistance to the occupation and colonization of their lands.
And as part of this, he had a relationship with the French governor.
Yes.
And the French governor considered his company to be so stimulating that he would just have him over for dinner all the time.
Right.
You know, and their conversation would turn into these debates, like you were talking about, you know, about the merits of the various cultures and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And La Honton would be present for these, you know.
And apparently he kept some good notes because, well, briefly to say that he kind of got exiled from France. He had some kind of falling out with the governor of New France and then was not even allowed to go back to the nation of France and had to live in exile in countries around the perimeter.
Yeah, he fell out with the government at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's unknown exactly what happened there. I mean, maybe it's known, but not to us from reading the book.
Yeah.
but he was doing pretty bad, kind of just like a mercenary spy, man about town, described as a vagrant in a lot of the descriptions from back then. But then he published a couple of memoirs, and they were very successful. And one of the memoirs was called Curious Dialogues with a Savage of Good Sense Who Has Traveled.
I love that.
Not the catchiest name for a book that we've ever heard, but
the Who Has Traveled, like, really kind of is the icing on the cake of that title. Yeah.
And in that book, he basically lays out these dialogues and kind of arguments between himself and an indigenous American that he had spent time with. And
who he calls Adario.
Oh, Adario is his name in the book.
In the book. And I think, you know, from what we have here, it's like unclear whether La Honton is presenting this as a fictional person.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get that impression. Yeah, that's interesting. I will say that he was read as a fictional person at a certain point, readers of that time, and then the interpretation over time until honestly maybe the past few decades was such that Adario was a fictional character that Lahontan could just put his revolutionary thoughts in the mouth of.
Yeah.
And that did become a trope somewhat in Enlightenment literature, to have like an other who's saying the critiques, who's saying the things. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is partially that when the church and state were still unified and in power, to say anything that questioned the Christian theology, to say anything that questioned the power structure, could be punishable even as a capital offense.
Right.
As heresy.
Right.
And so...
It would be convenient,
yes,
to put critiques of one's own European culture, mm-hmm, in the mouth of, say, an indigenous person from the Americas, mm-hmm, or a Persian or a Chinese person. Like, there were books written with all of these,
right,
types of...
Peruvian princess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So that was one of the ways this book, The Curious Dialogues, was read for quite a while.
Yeah.
But pretty recent... or recent-ish indigenous scholarship has made the case that this Adario was likely Candy Arang.
Yeah.
And specifically, they mention indigenous scholar Barbara Alice Mann as presenting very good evidence that Candy Arang was around a lot, that had these conversations, did travel to France, and had like a pretty vivid and exacting critique of French society from having been there.
Yeah.
And so she is presenting that this is not a fictionalized account. This is actually, although there's probably some embellishment and some fuzzy memory happening, that Adario is based on Candy Arang. And also, there are plenty of accounts that are not fictional of Jesuits and other people who were occupying those territories who discuss Candy Arang, name him by name, and give various examples of his criticism and points of debate.
Yeah.
Specifically, he had a lot of beef with Christianity. And
right,
so his criticism of that has stood there. And so there, when you compare the two, the firsthand accounts that are nonfiction and this memoir that people have called fiction, they're very similar.
Yeah. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but the chapter spends a fair amount of time justifying that we could even read these European accounts as actually containing real indigenous critiques,
mm-hmm,
right? Because apparently it's been the norm in academia or something for a long time to just conclude that the authors use the term sock puppet, that these Enlightenment thinkers, and there were apparently like a lot of Enlightenment authors who... it became like a trend, mm-hmm, to publish, like everyone had to publish their book in which they were saying that they had dialogues with somebody who was not European,
mm-hmm,
and included in that was a critique of European society, right?
Right?
And it was, like Janet was alluding to, like it was very commonly decided that this was just a projection of the Enlightenment, mm-hmm, folks' own critique, you know, into the mouths of people, that it was safer to have them saying that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Graeber and Wengrow spend kind of a lot of time like pushing them back against that idea and justifying the idea that we could actually take seriously that the Europeans were listening to indigenous Americans in this case, and that those critiques made their way into European culture, like directly from the mouths of indigenous Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't need a lot of convincing to believe that that was possible, but
right,
the chapter, you
spends
know,
a lot of
spends
time.
A lot of time with that.
Right. To give you guys a taste of what this memoir was like and what these debates that were being presented that were so popular in Europe at this point.
Yeah.
So we're talking like 1703 is when the memoir, The Curious Dialogues,
okay, right,
were
yeah,
put out. We're going to play a couple quotes from the audiobook again.
So this is before Rousseau.
Yeah, before Rousseau.
This is important.
Yes, that's true. All right, so Lahontan.
Lahontan. This is why the wicked need to be punished and the good need to be rewarded. Otherwise, murder, robbery, and defamation would spread everywhere. And in a word, we would become the most miserable people on the face of the earth. Candy Arang. For my own part, I find it hard to see how you could be much more miserable than you already are. What kind of human, What species of creature must Europeans be that they have to be forced to do good and only refrain from evil because of fear of punishment? You have observed that we lack judges. What is the reason for that? Well, we never bring lawsuits against one another. And why do we never bring lawsuits? Well, because we made a decision neither to accept or make use of money. And why do we refuse to allow money into our communities? The reason is this. We are determined not to have laws, because, since the world was a world, our ancestors have been able to live contentedly without them.
And then it seems like the more time that Candy Arronk spent in European company in the colonies and also over in Europe, in France, when he went there, he began to have more and more of a focus on property and money as the problem.
Yeah.
Private property.
He was honing his critique.
Yes, he was definitely honing his critique.
Yeah.
And so some of his most poignant criticism, although his criticism of Christianity is also
withering. And right on.
And right on.
It's so good.
His critique of money and what that seems to do to people and how it encourages Europeans to treat each other like shit.
Yeah.
Are some of the strongest quotes in this part.
Mm-hmm.
Candy Arronk. I have spent 6 years reflecting on the state of European society, and I still can't think of a single way they act that's not inhuman. And I genuinely think this can only be the case as long as you stick to your distinctions of mine and thine. I affirm that what you call money is the devil of devils, the tyrant of the French, the source of all evils, the bane of souls and slaughterhouse of the living. To imagine one can live in the country of money and preserve one's soul is like imagining one could preserve one's life at the bottom of a lake. Money is the father of luxury, lasciviousness, intrigues, trickery, lies, betrayal, insincerity, of all the world's worst behavior. Fathers sell their children, husbands their wives, wives betray their husbands, brothers kill each other, friends are false, and all because of money. In the light of all of this, tell me that we Wendat are not right in refusing to touch or so much as to look at silver.
And so, in case it's not clear, the conclusion of scholars nowadays, the scholars that have studied Candy Arronk and this book, are saying that these dialogues were reconstructed from notes that Lahontan had kept. Mm-hmm. You know, so they might not be exact quotes, mm-hmm. but they are very much the types of things that he would have said, you know.
Right. And part of the assumption that this was like a literary device and not an actual person has to do with some of the like really broad generalizations that are not actually like could never be exactly true.
Yeah.
Like, some of the dialogues will say things that like there are just basically like no laws in the Wendat Confederacy. And
right.
That's not true. You know.
Right. And when Candy Arronk is saying things that are somewhat inaccurate to his own society, like the authors of this bring up like, well, was he just embellishing mm-hmm. for the sake of argument, or is this actually a misquoting mm-hmm. on the part of Lahontan?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, for sure. But they also argue that when people are debating, that's what you do. Like, you exaggerate
exactly.
your point.
You exaggerate
the difference between you and the other group.
Exactly.
And so that's also in here. But it is clear that these quotes are similar enough to things that are recorded that he actually said.
Yeah.
That there is little question, at least in the indigenous scholarship examination of these
right.
multiple texts.
Yeah.
So the curious dialogues were very popular. They were translated into a bunch of languages.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though like decades had gone by and this was like remembered and brought back from notes by Lahontan, like Candy Arronk's brilliance just shines, comes through this.
Yeah.
You know, over like the fog of memory and years, like you just see it coming through.
Right. And whereas the Jesuit relations, which we talked about already, a previous bestseller in Europe, captured some of the same indigenous critique, in Lahontan's book, it was a expertly formulated
yes.
critique.
Right.
That really made an impact.
Yeah, it was kind of like a harsh bright light that if you looked at the culture in Europe with it, from within through this, with this light shined on it, it was pretty hard to not see the flaws.
Yeah, yeah. And it was not only its own bestseller, but it also set the template, apparently, for all of these other more famous Enlightenment authors like Voltaire and Montesquieu, whatever, who all, because of the popularity and the impact of this book, copied the basic premise and published their own, you know, dialogues with a savage or something of one kind or another.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And importantly, for what we're going to talk about later, Rousseau definitely read this book.
Yeah.
And it seems like most people writing in social theory, whatever side of the political spectrum they land on, read it and had to contend with it.
Yeah.
And that's going to be important.
Right.
Because some of the ways that conservative theorists contended with this book, we're still dealing with today.
Yeah. 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 And so when Graeber and Wengrow contend, as this chapter does, that the ideas that drove the European Enlightenment were influenced in large part from the indigenous critique of European society, this is some of the strong evidence for that being the case.
Right.
After the section on Candiaronc, we could say that this chapter enters into its final act.
Yes.
The home stretch, we might call it. And this part is concerned mostly with the history of ideas coming out of the Enlightenment and the legacy of some of what's been discussed already in the indigenous critique and what the European tradition did when it got a hold of it. This might be the part of the chapter where our reader could get a little bogged down because it is kind of thick with intellectual history and argumentation. But we're going to go through it because I think it is actually really important and important for the book. And it proceeds from being like really fascinating and I think important to being confusing and kind of upsetting by the end.
A little contentious. It gets contentious by the end. Yeah.
So we'll go through this. The first part of it introduces a figure who seems to be very important in intellectual history, but is not a household name by any measure at the level of Rousseau or Thomas Hobbes. And this is a guy named A.R.J. Turgot.
Yeah, I'd never heard of him before this, which maybe says more about me than it does about him. But
yeah, and Turgot, he comes onto the stage in relation to a book called Letters of a Peruvian Woman by a prominent French Salonist named Madame de Graffigny. And this book was published in 1747, Letters of a Peruvian Woman. And it is an example of this type of book where a French intellectual was using an indigenous character to make a critique of European society. And in this case, the indigenous character was an imaginary kidnapped Inca princess named Zilia. And we don't get a lot about the book, but Zilia was portrayed very positively in the book. And the Inca Empire was portrayed by the protagonist as kind of a benevolent despotism, where even though there was an emperor, everybody else was basically equal.
And actually equal. Like, not equal before the law, but, like, had the same amount of stuff.
Yeah, right. Like, materially equal.
Right.
And Zilia, who was from the Inca Empire, but living in France, maybe, is wondering why the French king can't just redistribute wealth to get rid of poverty and need, you know? And so the book kind of contains this critique. The book was very popular. And at one point, Madame de Graffigny was going to do a second edition of the book or a subsequent edition. And she solicited comments from her circle of friends about if there's anything that she should change or include in the new edition of the book. Thought that was kind of interesting. And one of the people who responded was this guy, Turgot, A.R.J. Turgot. And Turgot at the time was a 23-year-old seminary student. And he thought that the book did not have a good message at all. And in fact, it had a very dangerous message. And he wrote to Madame de Graffigny And I'm just going to read a little bit of Graeber and Wengrow's summary of what he wrote to her. They don't quote the letter really at length at all, although it says that Turgot acknowledges that we all love the idea of freedom and equality in principle. But then he goes on to describe that as societies evolve from this like earlier stage of equality and freedom as savages, as they were called at the time, as societies evolve, technology advances, and natural differences in talents and capacities between individuals, which have always existed, become more significant. And eventually they form the basis for an ever more complex division of labor. We progress from simple societies like those of the Wendat to our own complex commercial civilization, quote-unquote, in which the poverty and dispossession of some, however lamentable it may be, is nonetheless the necessary condition for the prosperity of society as a whole. So Turgot is outlining this idea of the sort of inevitable progression out of the state of nature into more technologically advanced and also more unequal societies. So Turgot, you know, according to the intellectual history that's being outlined here, he's maybe the first person, you might say, to present this as kind of an inevitable evolution through a series of linear stages from one stage of complexity, quote unquote, to the next. Instead of just being different possibilities in which people could live, this is viewed now as a progression. Turgot also just says a bunch of false statements in here and makes misleading and wrong conclusions. Like, for instance, he takes, and this is something that a lot of right-wingers still do today, he takes the fact that people naturally have different talents and capacities to mean that that fact will inevitably lead to differences in power and wealth.
Yeah, I actually am so struck by that part because he, it's so wild. He like takes the like meritocracy idea that people have what they deserve because of their talents and gifts and strengths. That's how people get to have power and wealth in society. And he does that back on a societal level to be like, at the beginning, this is how these emerged. Like someone just had, was better at
someone, you know, could pick 400 tubers out of the ground in the amount of time it took another person to pick 250. And then so that person just becomes wealthy. And so they end up having more power over this other person. And, you know, this is very ahistorical and just totally theoretical. It's also exactly the way that people like Jordan Peterson still like to argue today that, like, you know, differences in ability naturally lead to hierarchies of dominance and power. You know, but still, this argument has not gone away, you know, and it completely overlooks the fact that in a lot of traditional societies, societies all over time and place, differences in ability did not translate into hierarchy and differences in power, you know, and
there's wealth accumulation
or wealth accumulation, you know, and there's all sorts of mechanisms that a culture can adopt to prevent that from happening, despite the fact that, yes, people are different, you know. And so, but anyway, this is completely overlooked. Turgot is completely invested in defending French society at the time, saying that it was more prosperous for everybody overall, and that the cost of this was a degree of inequality and hierarchy, you know? So this is should be a familiar line of argument to most people. And Graeber and Wengrow are saying that this kind of originates right here with Turgot. Anyway, the author of Letters from a Peruvian Woman ignored this request of his because he suggested that she have Zilia, the protagonist, sort of realize this at the end of the book. and Madame de Graffigny was like, no thanks. I'm just going to keep the ending as it is. Nevertheless, Turgot went on to develop this theory of stages in a series of popular historical lectures that he would give, where he spread this idea. And the idea was then taken up by people like Adam Smith, early theorist of capitalism and Enlightenment economist dude. And from there, the theory of stages what is called sometimes in the book stageism, became a long-term and durable legacy of European intellectual history. Mm-hmm. And so this is very important, right? This part of the book is actually really important because stageism has a long history, mm-hmm. and it's something that by now has been debunked. Like, anthropologists don't really utilize it anymore, which you wouldn't get the feeling that they don't utilize it anymore necessarily by reading The Dawn of Everything, but it has held sway for mm-hmm. a long time, and people like Steven Pinker, Jared Diamond, mm-hmm. or whatever still kind of bring in stagist type ideas when they are making their arguments. So it is very important to recognize stageism for what it is, mm-hmm. And to understand the critique of it, you know, and to like understand what it was invented to try and defend, you know. So with stageism, we get the idea that progress, like there's mm-hmm. an inevitable progress.
Right.
Like if you just plop humans down into a state of nature, then just their natural interactions will drive them towards a civilization like ours in a one way, like linear, inevitable way.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that when you employ the kind of stagist framework, it means that you get to see people living in different ways as more primitive and more as a less advanced version of society who will inevitably get to the place you're at in your quote unquote advanced society. Like yeah. they're just at a like lesser mm-hmm. stage of development and will mm-hmm. eventually get where you're at anyway. So they can say whatever they want, criticism-wise, yeah. but they aren't actually dealing with the reality of a complex society yet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And as we'll see later on, I mean, just a couple pages later, the authors actually make that very point mm-hmm. almost, that part of the way that stagism and part of what Turgot was doing, mm-hmm. like maybe, I don't know, consciously or not, but pretty consciously,
yeah, consciously I'd say.
Was he's implying that any critique of French society, you know, coming from a member of an earlier stage of development, which like the Wendat he would have considered would be an earlier stage of development. I mean, even though they had towns and they were agricultural, you know, all this stuff, the implication is that their critique and their example is actually not relevant mm-hmm. to European culture
right.
because they belong to a different stage.
Right.
And so whatever they might think or do or something is only relevant to that stage. We've moved on to a different stage. And so therefore there's no, you know, what makes sense in one stage does not make sense in another. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way of kind of consigning the whole indigenous critique to like a closet of irrelevance, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's part of what they're pointing out here.
And I think also what I was struck by with his summary and framework is that you also see the kernel of conservative right-wing beliefs in and like acceptance of capitalism, acceptance of hierarchy and domination, all of the things, mm-hmm. in that he thinks it's for the greater good. Like yeah. as a whole, if you averaged out how everyone's doing, because some people are so wealthy,
yeah,
it means everyone's doing better.
Right.
Even though many of like the most poor are doing terribly and worse than people are at these so-called lower stages of development, mm-hmm. it's still like a greater good because if you averaged the wealth of everybody, it would be a higher level of wealth or something.
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, and Steven Pinker, who we talked about last episode, he explicitly makes this argument. You
totally.
Know? And he's like, well, even the lower classes in the U.S. still get like vaccines and like modern healthcare and these things that improve their lives beyond what it would have been 200 years ago or 300 years ago or something. You know, so these kinds of arguments come in.
Yeah.
But it's always conservative. It's always right wing. It's always a defense of mm-hmm. what is, you know, against whatever would critique it.
Right.
So Turgot is definitely, he is a conservative, like this is a right wing argument. And what Graeber and Wengrow do from here is they actually bring us back to Rousseau. Mm-hmm. So Rousseau, this is going to be almost the end of talking about Rousseau for the book, you know, just in case you're tired of the Rousseau stuff. But they come down pretty hard on Rousseau here at the end of this chapter. Uh-huh. And it's for this reason. They return to Rousseau's essay on the discourse on the origins of equality. They give some history around the essay and the context in which it was written and stuff that we're not going to cover here. But basically, what they accuse Rousseau of doing is that Rousseau has an ambivalent relationship with the arc of human history. Mm-hmm. On one hand, he thinks that people had it better and were lived morally better lives, less cruelty, less violence in the state of nature, and that we've actually morally declined into like a really reprehensible state. You know, I mean, he was speaking from the 18th century, so at the time when he was living, and so he was a critic of his time period, right? And he thought that it actually, that life got worse going through time. Yet he also portrays history as kind of going through stages, similar to the way Turgot does. For Rousseau, there were three stages. One of them was the state of nature. One of them, the next one was like Stone Age savagery, quote unquote. And then the third one was agricultural civilization and metallurgy, you know, and that was where he was living at the time. And to progress, to move through these stages is a decline in quality of life, you know? So he had that as a critique. But still, he portrayed the stages as being linear and kind of one would progress from the other sort of naturally in the same way that Turgot says. And that also the progression through the stages was irreversible. So Rousseau, even though he's a critic of the society in which he lives, he still articulates this as a trap. And not that there's lots of different ways that people can live and they're all available to us now, but that we're kind of stuck here in this progressed stage. And we got here through like natural progressivist type of means, similar to Turgot. So what Graeber and Wengrow are saying is that like, yeah, so Rousseau, he's left wing, he's a critic, he believes there should be more freedom and equality, but he also sneaks in this Turgotist kind of stagism.
Well, and it also has like the fall, the myth of the fall and, built in. So which is like more of the Abrahamic faith setup where we were in this Edenic space, we were in this golden age, we fell from that and we cannot unfall.
That's true. He totally has that. Yeah, he totally has that. So Rousseau is a problematic figure. At the same time as he was influenced by the indigenous critique, you can also see in his theorizing the presence of the liberal capitalist enlightenment individualist subjectivity. That's definitely in there and is part of his legacy. But the most important things to Graeber and Wengrow are a couple, and I'm just going to highlight these. We've kind of said them before, but one of them is extremely important, is his portrayal of humans in a state of nature, the original humans, as being fundamentally innocent and kind of childlike.
Right.
So this is a huge critique, and I'm on board with this critique.
Right. And it's not just a critique of theirs, like that's an indigenous critique of Rousseau as well.
Yeah, right. And, you know, so Rousseau has this idea that humans in the state of nature, the original humans, are innocent of power, innocent of violence, and unprepared for the arrival of these things as they would come to emerge as they started moving up the ladder of progress.
Right.
And it's their innocence and sort of childlike unpreparedness that makes us easy to get caught in the trap that we're caught in now. You know?
They're basically like unthinking in their lives. They're just kind of being.
Right.
And that's that is a, honestly, like, can be a kind of stereotyping idealization of indigenous peoples around the world that other people do still. There's this idea of just
being. And Graeber and Wengrow talk about this a lot. You know, they think that this is still alive.
Very much so, yeah.
For sure. And they have a whole little thing in here where they say, like, Rousseau is associated with the myth of the noble savage when actually he didn't actually promulgate the myth of the noble savage, but we think that what he's actually guilty of is the myth of the stupid savage. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of their crude way of talking about this,
right?
That humans in a state of nature are ignorant mm-hmm. of power and the implications of it, mm-hmm. you know, and a whole bunch of other things. Right.
And also, I think this is a place where they continually throughout the book want to say, like, we're going to act like people that have existed at any point in history and prehistory are people just like us. They're not that different. They just have different societies.
Yeah.
And they're saying that this way of looking at people in the state of nature does not treat them like people.
Yeah, right. You know? Right, right. Yeah. They will later be talking about the primordial human soup, you know, like we shouldn't treat the people of prehistory as if they're just stewing in a primordial human soup, you know, which is kind of almost like they're not even people at all yet. Mm-hmm. They're just like some mass of unformed infantile reality.
Or like, know? What people will emerge from, the, yeah. the elements that will make up humans,
right.
but not quite human.
Right. Yeah, so there's hunter-gatherer. I mean, okay, so sometimes I will say the word hunter-gatherer. That's the modern term, but this is like what is being discussed here, you mm-hmm. know, right? It's a hunter-gatherer is someone who lives without agriculture. I mean, period. Like, that's the definition of it, right? But anyway, hunter-gatherer innocence, right? They're against this, like, innocence, what they call stupidity, ignorance of power. Mm-hmm. So they're accusing Rousseau of that. And then also Rousseau is doing stagism, mm-hmm. progressive stages that are irreversible.
Even if he sees them as ultimately having a negative outcome,
right?
They're still progressive, not in the sense of evolving positively, but progressive as in they come in stages and one builds on the last.
Yeah, exactly. So at this point, I'm like, okay, great. This is all very good. I think that they make a good case that Rousseau's thought actually has all these features, mm-hmm. and they make a good case for rejecting those features of Rousseau's thought. But then it's at the end here that things get really dicey, mm-hmm. and they make a devious move that I think itself should be rejected. And it goes kind of like this. Basically, they start from this reasonable critique of Rousseau, mm-hmm. and from there, they proceed to take aim at anyone who concludes that prehistoric humanity before agriculture was typified by egalitarian relations. Okay, because this is their true target. Mm. Rousseau is just a means to an end. Their true target are people who persist in thinking that human life before agriculture was greatly egalitarian. Mm-hmm. And there's a very robust and rigorous branch of anthropology that has come to this very conclusion about primitive hunter-gatherers, mm-hmm. right? And that's something that we'll have to talk about more. Mm-hmm. But at the end, they attack any contemporary person who holds this view of egalitarian hunter-gatherers mm-hmm. by equating them basically with Rousseau. Oof. By saying they are just doing what Rousseau is doing. And remember, Rousseau has this idea of hunter-gatherer innocence. Mm-hmm. And Rousseau has this idea of progressive irreversible stages. And like, I happen to know enough about hunter-gatherer anthropology that the people who they're taking aim at don't hold those views. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of using Rousseau as like a straw man sort of mm-hmm. to get at this other idea of primitive egalitarianism, mm-hmm. you know, by saying that this is just equivalent to Rousseau, basically. And we've already showed how Rousseau was bad. And these people have this Rousseauian idea about the good times before agriculture. And basically, for the whole rest of the book, mm-hmm. anytime the idea of egalitarian hunter-gatherers is brought up, it will be labeled by Graeber and Wengrow as a claim to hunter-gatherer innocence. Mm. You know, so now egalitarian equals innocent because they're equating it to the way Rousseau made his point. Mm. You get that?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they're going to keep doing. Mm-hmm. You know, so part of what we're tracking here is like the kinds of mm-hmm. arguments and the persuasion and the rhetoric that they are trying to set up. Mm-hmm. Now, they don't like the concept of egalitarianism at all. And the last four pages here are a sustained assault on the whole concept of equality and egalitarianism. Not that like those would be good values or something, like they're not saying, they're not arguing for inequality, mm-hmm. but they're just saying that the terminology is vague and poor, and maybe we shouldn't even be talking about equality at all. Mm-hmm. So we talked about this a little bit in chapter one. And if you have actually read chapter two, Wicked Liberty, then you will have noticed something that we have left out up until now. And that's that, like, there's this persistent kind of fucking with the notion of equality, inequality, egalitarianism throughout it. And the authors make a big deal of pointing out that the indigenous critique didn't even include a critique of inequality, and that that was something that kind of emerged later. And, you know, they think that's really important. We haven't covered it here up until now because, I mean, you know, just speaking for myself, like, I don't share their concern with the concept of inequality. I think their arguments are confusing. I don't understand why they're obsessed with this. But here at the end, they spend four pages, like, really trying to just sink once and for all the idea of egalitarianism and equality as, like, a meaningful political concept. Mm-hmm. And I've already registered an objection to that idea because I think that we can define equality in a political sense as having an equal say in common affairs. Mm-hmm. But then to really distill the point that they're trying to make here at the end and get at, like, the stakes of what this is about for them, they say that it remains entirely unclear what egalitarian even means. And they say that the only reason why this term is even used is that it's a default term, I'm reading from the book, that refers to that kind of protoplasmic mass of humanity that one imagines being left over when all the trappings of civilization are taken away. So this is their critique of Rousseau, right? This, like, primordial soup of humanity. Mm-hmm. And so now they're saying that anyone who talks about equality or egalitarianism is doing this. Mm-hmm. In the next paragraph, they say it follows that any historical work that purports to be about the origins of social inequality is really an inquiry into the origins of civilization. This seems to me to be factually untrue, mm-hmm. because a lot of people have inquired into the origins of, say, gender inequality,
right,
which are way older than civilization. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't even know what they're talking about here. And then they say that, in turn, that implies a vision of history like that of Turgot, which conceives of civilization as a system of complexity guaranteeing overall prosperity. So without really any argumentation along the way, they're saying, if you speak of egalitarianism as, like, a feature of a society or as a value that we could aspire to, then you are like Rousseau, therefore hunter-gatherer, primordial childlike innocence, and stagism, and you are just as good as Turgot. You are actually right-wing. You are defending civilization. And this is all because we want to speak about equality or egalitarianism. I mean, this is what is being proposed here. Mm-hmm. I read this a number of times. So this is upsetting. This is what I was talking about being upsetting.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that what I feel like might be necessary to do at this point, and we're going to save this for our next episode, but I want us to spend some time talking about the rest of the world of anthropology and hunter-gatherer studies. And I want to give some space to the people who Graeber and Wengrow are actually arguing with here.
Who they're not naming.
Because they're explicitly arguing with Turgot and Rousseau and Steven Pinker and all of this stuff. But they're sideways arguing with colleagues of theirs in anthropology who study hunter-gatherers and have a whole discourse around egalitarianism, power in hunter-gatherer, nomadic, pastoral, agricultural civilizations that does not get meaningfully engaged with in this book. Mm-hmm. Only these kind of sideways jabs,
right,
you know? And so what I want to do next time is bring in some of this other anthropology so that we can give it space in these conversations, right? Because there's a whole body of theory out there and anthropology that makes a lot better arguments than Rousseau does.
Right.
You know, and we should give them some space.
Right. I'm super excited about the next episode. Because also we'll be able to give you guys a lot of names, a lot of research, some articles, some books you might want to look at.
Yeah.
So that if you're interested in looking into what other radical anthropologists are doing and what conclusions they're coming to.
Yeah.
That are not always written for a popular audience. You can go down those paths and look at those sources as well.
Yeah. A lot of this I just learned about sort of recently, and it's been very...
It's fascinating.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it's definitely fascinating. Yeah, and also, just so you know, like the next chapter after this, so the third episode is going to be about this, these other people in the field, the colleagues of Wingo and Graeber. And but then the next chapter, which is Unfreezing the Ice Age.
Yeah, chapter three.
That'll be episode four. It's pretty long. So if you're reading along, you could go ahead and start.
Oh,
that,
sure. Yeah.
You know?
No harm in getting ahead.
Because it's pretty long and we'll be working on that alongside this other one anyway. So
yeah,
it's worth reading. I guess I was wondering if maybe it would be good just to, because we're ending with a pretty, like, harsh criticism here, which I think is completely valid.
Yeah.
Is there any, like, takeaway from this chapter that we think is good and valuable and we want to keep? Like, what could we touch back on that at all?
Well, I think that their critiques of Rousseau are great.
Yeah.
And that, you know, because we do still see, especially in these kind of non-expert, popular thinkers like Steven Pinker or whatever, we still see echoes of this, it's good, you know, to be clear about what's bad about that.
And I think it's good to have a criticism of stagism and understand if we use a progressive stagist model for humanity, we're not allowing for the wide variety of forms of society and the ways that those have emerged,
right,
have happened over time. And
right,
that, and some of what we're going to talk about next time will actually point to some of that.
Yeah.
But that...
and it limits our own horizons of possibility.
Absolutely. Totally.
Which is, I mean, that's...
That's the point of the book.
That's the point of this book, is to expand
our
horizons of possibility.
Right.
Yes.
So we want to highlight and keep that, the
yeah,
critique of stagism, and remember also that... And so this is one more thing I will say that's a little bit critical, but, you know, they're not great about tying humans into the larger ecologies around them, and that's probably going to come up in the next episode as well.
Yeah.
But we can try to work on that as we go and discuss this and just say that humans are part of nature. We are, we emerge and live and even evolve, whatever words you want to use. We live in the ways that other forms of life live.
Yeah.
Which means nonlinear, which means going in all directions.
Right.
It means not progressive. So
yeah,
by that, I mean that human society, just like other forms of life, branches off, goes in different directions, goes in, is multi-directional, does not go in, it's not like a train, you know? Human life in societal form is multiple branching and multifaceted and expansive and all of these words that we would use to describe the rest of life. Humans aren't different.
Right.
And many, many different sciences, including like this historical social theory type of science, want things to be more linear and progressive and arboreal than they are.
Right, right.
And so I'm also kind of keeping that, even though they don't really go into how human society mirrors the rest of life.
Right.
I'm thinking about it that way.
That's compatible with what they're trying to promote here.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. 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 So we can hold on to all that. And then also just the brilliance of Candy Aronk.
Yeah, we will definitely keep Candy Aronk.
And the incredible realization that some of the liberal democratic values that we were inculcated with in the democratic West, like things that we learned in elementary school about freedom and equality, the supposed ideals of our civilization, are direct imports from indigenous American cultures.
Yeah, and that European social theorists who have gotten credit for these ideas learn to look at themselves through the eyes of indigenous critics.
Right, exactly.
And they used those well-thought-out and well-said criticisms, and then they got credit for it, you know? So
right,
it's like an interesting... This is a continuing pattern in colonial interaction, of course.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess we're going to leave this chapter now, leave Wicked Liberty behind.
Yeah, I'm going to go walk it off.
Yeah, go walk it off. I'm very excited about talking about some anthropology, some on-the-ground field work happening, and conclusions drawn by radical anthropologists next time.
Bringing in some other voices into this.
I think some other voices will be good right now.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's exciting, and I hope you're all doing well. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
Thank you.